Blog Talk Radio.
You have tuned in to the Brain Injury Radio Network with shows 7 nights a week. You can find the network at braininjuryradio.com or look up Brain Injury Radio Network on Facebook. Another Fork in the Road with your host, Donna O'Donnell Fugerski.
Hi, and welcome to the Brain Injury Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com. My name is Donna O'Donnell Fugerski, and I'm your host on my show, Another Fork in the Road. My show airs on the first and third Sunday of every month at 5:30 p.m. Pacific Time. Another Fork in the Road is for anyone with a brain injury, anyone who is caring for a brain-injured person, or anyone with any interest in learning more about brain injury. Brain injury is not discriminating. It can happen to anyone, anytime, and anywhere. And let me tell you, it does. The Brain Trauma Foundation states that there are more than 5 million people in the United States alone living with some form of brain injury. But most folks do not even know about brain injury. I know I never did, not until it came to live on my doorstep. On Another Fork in the Road, I try to raise awareness of brain injury and to help folks understand what survivors and caregivers experience. On the third Sunday of each month, I interview brain injury survivors or caregivers to see how they traverse their world of brain injury. I host therapists, medical professionals, and authors to gain insight into what they offer survivors. And on each first Sunday of the month, I host a discussion panel to examine pertinent topics related to brain injury, such as depression, neural fatigue, anger, or any one of the various symptoms of brain injury. Our next show in 3 weeks because January has an extra Sunday. So in 3 weeks, we're going to be talking about resolutions. And it sounds kind of funny to talk about resolutions in February, but we're going to look at if people did make resolutions and how they're kind of faring with them. I think that will be an interesting conversation. So I hope you'll join us then too. So for those of you who might be new to my show, here's a little snippet about me. I came on the brain injury scene in 2005 when my husband David had a brain injury. And you can learn more about that on my blog. And this is where I always remember to tell folks, have a pencil and paper nearby, because I will be giving you some URLs that you might want to copy down and check out after the show. After the show, not now, but yeah, but they're good to hang on to just to, for later use too. So survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com, that's the name of my blog, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. It's all one word, it's all lowercase. So you can go there. There are lots and lots and lots of things there, including interviews from survivors and caregivers, a lot of interesting information about COVID that's up there, a lot of itty-bitty giant steps, blog posts from other people in the brain injury community, just tons of stuff. You just, trust me, just go and look. You can get lost there for an afternoon. But on there, I shared my story and David's story, actually. It's his story before it became mine. In 4 episodes on this very show, starting in August of 2014. So if you're interested in learning about that, all you need to do is go to survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com, scroll down on the right to On the Air Show Menu. There are 2 On the Airs, but you want the show menu. And the show menu will list all the shows that I have hosted since August of 2014. So you can listen to any one of the shows there. It will be Just a little tiny detail with the title of the show and probably what it's about and probably the guest name on most of them. So you can find out that there. So on November, the last one I did was in November 2014 on that series. But I recently, well, not so recent, but in April 19, 2020, I interviewed David on my, and David's my husband who has the brain injury, on my show for his perspective on his brain injury after 15 years. And because he is a retired professor of microbiology, I wanted his understanding of the COVID-19 pandemic. So I have to tell you, he did research, daily research, hours and hours and hours of it to try to get, to break down what was going on with COVID. So, and he puts it into people's terms. I mean, like real people's terms, like mine, not scientifically. So he'll take the scientific papers and he'll break them down so we can understand them. So check that out too. It's a pretty interesting area. You can find my archive shows, as I just said, on my blog at survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. Just click on that on-the-air show menu in the category section on the right bar, and that's the easiest way to find any of my shows. Or you can type, if you're interested in David or anybody, if you know they're on the show, just type their name in the search box or a topic in the search box, and I promise you, it will come up. If I've done it, it'll come up. So you can also read our complete story in my book, which was published in November 2018. It's called Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale. You know what? That title is so apt for us because of David's disabilities and not being able to freely move out of the house without, you know, assistance by me. But I think during the pandemic, I think we can all relate to that, being a prisoner without bars, as we all went into isolation or hibernation or whatever ation we did while we tried to stay safe from the COVID virus. So you can. My book was published by Right Life Publishing, and it was, like I said, released in 2018, November. And so you can find Prisoners, as I so fondly call it, as an ebook, as a print book, and as an audiobook, which I most recently was published in December, I think, of, yeah. Oh, I don't know. December of 20, I think. Anyhow, yeah, it had to be December of 20. So anyhow, but go to Amazon or any of your favorite book comps and just put Prisoners Without Bars and my last name, Figurski, and it will come up. So go to my website if you want to learn more about me, DonnaFigurski.com. You'll learn so much about me, more than you ever wanted to know. And you can also see all the cast of characters in the book, most of them, not the infamous ones, the ones that will remain nameless. Anyway, I hope that you will visit the shows of the other hosts on the Brain Injury Radio Network. There are shows every night between 7 and 10 Pacific time. And you can also tune in at 5:30 p.m. Pacific time on weekends to listen to your favorite shows, too. So Brain Injury Radio airs across the United States, in all 50 states, and in 36 countries. Now, sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. And tonight, I have a guest because it is the third Sunday of the month, and I'm going to introduce you to her in just a moment. But I want to just kind of get us warmed up into the show. And I just want to talk about risks. You know, we take risks every day in our life, every day. Risks that we don't even give it a second thought to. Think about it. Do you ever take a bath or a shower? Yeah, of course. Risk. Do you ever step off the curb or just go for a walk? Risk. Do you ever get behind the wheel of a car or allow yourself to be a passenger in a car? Risk. Risk. We all do. We do those things every day and for most time. No falls. We walk down the street without falls. We smile at our neighbors and we say hello. We drive to work or school. We run errands to the grocery store. We go to the doctor's appointments. We do all of these things every single day. We visit our friends and we don't come into any meet up with any uncomfortable consequences. most of the time. Most of the time we don't. All is good, you know? And that's how we go through our life. And you have to. You have to go through your life that way. You can't live in a bubble. But what about the time you slip in the bathtub or a trip on a crack on the sidewalk or worse still, become involved in a car accident? Accidents happen all the time. We never know when they're going to happen. We can't really prepare for them, but we must make accommodations for accidents after they happen. And that's what Dawn Wasserman Corbelli and her daughter Veronica must do every day after they were involved in a car accident together. The car accident was a life changer for both Dawn and her daughter when they each suffered a brain injury. What some people don't realize, though, that the life changer also affected Dawn's husband and her other daughter. Accidents or brain injuries, survivors of brain injuries are not the only ones affected. The family is affected, the friends are affected, and I think that's something that we don't often say, but I think it's also a good thing to be able to hear. As I know, Dawn's husband is listening in here too, and a lot of kudos goes out to him for his role in the brain injury, because it's shared. Unfortunately, it's shared. In our family, David had the brain injury, but it happened to me too. I didn't get the injury, but the repercussions also fall back on the caregiver, and that's just the way it is, you know. And that's it's okay. It's okay. So I want to introduce to you Dawn Wasserman Corbelli. Dawn and her daughter Veronica are both survivors of a near fatal car accident, which happened in 2018. Veronica was only 15 years old. Dawn and Veronica suffered multiple injuries. 2008, that's what I meant. It's in my notes. It says 2008. You think I would have been able to see that. But anyhow, thank you for correcting that. 2008. Veronica was only 15 years old at the time, and they both suffered multiple injuries in the accident, including brain injuries. I mean, physical injuries as well as brain injuries. This evening, Dawn will share her and her daughter's stories of recovery and coping with their new lives. And Dawn is the author of a new book out, A Miracle a Day, One Day at a Time, Hope After Traumatic Brain Injury. A really interesting title there because it's also apropos. So hi, Dawn, and welcome to Another Fork in the Road. I'm glad to have you here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Great. You know, Dawn, I saw the photo of the accident on your book cover, and it's actually amazing that you are here to talk with us tonight about what happened. But before we go into that event, can you please tell me and my audience what your life was like before your accident? And before we even get into that part, I just want to go back a step here, because anyone who clicks on Dawn's book on Amazon will see the picture on the front cover of the car and Dawn and her daughter. And you have to just wonder how in the world anybody lived through that. So I'm really happy that you did. I know that there comes a lot of consequences with it, a lot of problems with health and brain injury issues. But I, for one, am glad that both you and Veronica are here. So can you just tell us a little bit about what your life was like before your accident?
Excuse me. I wanted to tell you, on my book, it's under Dawn Corbelli. It doesn't have Wasserman in it. I just needed to tell you that before we start. Lives before the accident were very easygoing. The kids were in school. They were in high school. They went to volleyball games. We worked at the school during the volleyball games at the little food counter, and my husband would help out with whatever he could whenever there was a tournament. He would keep score, and we had a lot of people in our home. The kids were very popular. We had up to 12 kids at our table for dinner sometimes.
Yeah.
Wow. It was a very easygoing life.
Cook.
I'm sorry?
I just said, you must be a good cook.
Oh, thank you. The kids appreciated it. We always baked together.
So.
They were very at home at our house. It was just a really easygoing life.
Wow.
And then after the accident, everything was different. Veronica, when we were in the car, Veronica was driving and she had her permit. And we were stopped at a stop sign and we didn't see a truck coming and they didn't see us. They were going 60 miles an hour and we were going 5 miles an hour out from the stop sign. Mm-hmm. It was our fault. There was no skid marks. So we don't know how they didn't see us either. So Veronica ended up, her blood pressure at the scene was 52 over zero. We didn't think she was going to make it. She got a severe traumatic brain injury, a frontal lobe injury, the physical injuries, 8 breaks in her pelvis, 2 broken hips, a broken left ankle, and her left side was paralyzed. I had 6 breaks in my pelvis and a 9 staples in my head. And I lost 7 weeks of my memory after the accident. I have a moderate traumatic brain injury, and hers is severe. And she lost 3 months before and 3 months after.
That has never returned.
Nope.
Her memory for that period.
Never returned.
Yeah, I know. It's so bizarre how that has happened. I have a friend who, and she has also a book too, who had a fan drop on her head. She fell, hit the counter, hit the floor, had a severe brain injury, and it has no memory of her previous life. She was about 20-something at this time. She had a little child and a husband. She did not remember them. And you have to wonder, how does this happen? Yet we know it does. You know, it does. It's gone, and you just can't piece it back together again. Something happened in that area of the brain to erase that memory. And it's really bizarre. It's really bizarre that happens. So you kind of went right over my second question, which was really fine. So I know that having a brain injury and understanding the huge consequence of it are confusing. I mean, I think brain injury is confusing, I think, to anybody, because most of us, if you're like me, you didn't know anything about it. And when David had his brain injury in 2005, I didn't know anything about brain injury. So I didn't understand the magnitude of it. And I wonder if you even understood the magnitude of it at that point. You say that you had a moderate brain injury, and yet, and I know that the doctors probably labeled that for you, but I'm going to disagree on that. I think there is no moderate. There is no mild brain injury. I think when you have a brain injury, you've impacted your brain and impacted your life in such a way that I don't know how anyone can say it's mild when it's something, you know, as serious as a brain injury. But I know that they do put labels on things like that. But I thought when David...
they go by how long you have been knocked out for. How long you were unconscious.
Yeah. And that really doesn't tell you a whole lot, I don't think. You know, I can see that, but, you know, it doesn't really say anything to me. But I'm not a medical person, so I'm not going to, you know, I'm just saying what I feel. That's all. But when that news was presented to me about David's injury, when I was told that he had a traumatic brain injury, like I said, I really didn't know what that meant. I truly thought that when David was transported to the hospital that fateful morning of January 13, 2005, which is, if you looked at the calendar right now, that was only 3 days ago, 17 years and 3 days ago, and we relived it, but we're going to talk about that a little later in the show. I thought he would be coming home that afternoon. I mean, I even asked the paramedics. I mean, this is naivety on my part. You'd think I would know better. But I didn't understand the magnitude of this, you know, and I said, well, you know, can you guys give us a ride home afterwards? I'm going to go in the ambulance with you. I'm not taking my car. I mean, like, Donna, when I think about it now, I'm embarrassed to even tell anybody, but I think it is something, I do share the story and the embarrassment, because I think that's what many people are feeling. They don't really know what's going on. And I truly did not know what was going on, because I was really, really wrong. David's three brain surgeries kept him a guest of either the hospital or the or rehab hospital for nearly 3 months. So I didn't need any ride home at that point. But how did you come to terms, Dawn, with your brain injury, and how did you deal with it?
Well, I'm sorry. After my brain injury, I couldn't remember even if I had eaten breakfast. And Veronica and I were in the hospital at the same time, and I can't remember if I said she also had a sheared brainstem, which most people don't live through. And every day my husband had to tell me more than once that Veronica had had been in the ICU, that we'd been in an accident, and he didn't even know about her brain injury for a while. He didn't. Nobody told him that she had a traumatic brain injury. And he found out probably close to 2 weeks after. He didn't know until somebody just happened to mention it.
Oh, my God.
And
just happened to mention a traumatic brain injury? That's like crazy, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, that would be the first thing that a doctor would tell you. That's, my gosh. How unsettling. Yeah.
So he just had to keep telling me over and over.
Uh-huh. Because you were not able to comprehend it at that time? Comprehend it, or you just did not remember it? Just didn't remember it. Yeah, wow. And that's not unusual. That's not unusual at all for people to not remember before or after an accident, or even having long-term memory loss, years after, or short-term memory loss, too. That also happens. Those are some of the things that survivors of brain injury go through, and they're invisible. People don't know that, and we're going to talk about that again, too, in a few minutes. But I want to work through this in sort of an organized manner. So as you were in the throes of your brain injury and trying to sort out your life, you were also obviously very concerned and engaged in your daughter Veronica's healing. So can you talk about that? How did you deal with that? I know you were in the hospital every day for hours after you were finally released. Can you talk about how you dealt with all that, how your family dealt with all that?
Yes. So I was in the hospital for 3 weeks, and once I got out, I already knew I wasn't remembering things because my husband was telling me that. So I decided to keep a journal every day we went to visit Veronica. I kept a journal of everything that went on, and we would go there once a day and two times on Saturday and Sunday, and I wrote down everything, and that's the only way I could remember everything. And then after that, there was a lot of things I couldn't remember, and something very specific that comes to mind is I went to refill prescription, and prescriptions have numbers on them, and I could only remember one or two numbers at a time, and sometimes they have seven numbers, and now our prescriptions have 10 numbers, and I kept telling my husband, I can't do this, and he was under so much pressure, he started yelling at me, probably the only time that he got upset with me like that, because he got PTSD from all of this going on. And I didn't know that, so he didn't understand that I couldn't remember, and I didn't understand what he was going through. And he never refilled prescriptions before the accident. That was my job.
Yeah.
So I just tried and tried and tried, and it took me a lot of times, and I still kept that job even afterwards. And it was really, really hard.
Wow.
And with Veronica,
so many things right here. Go ahead.
And with Veronica, she was forgetting. She was in the hospital for 12 weeks and one day. And when she got out, of course, her memory was really bad. And to this day, almost 14 years later, I can tell her what we're doing that day and say, we're going to Walmart today. And then a little while later, she'll ask me again, what are we doing today? And I will ask her like she's never asked before, because I believe it's a matter of dignity and respect. It's not her fault. I'm not going to snap at her like she already knows or like I've already told her, because she doesn't remember. And I just repeat things over and over and over. So that's how we deal with the lack of memory. And I'm sorry?
I was gonna say, Cindy, but go ahead. If you're still talking on this, go ahead. It's not a problem. I'll catch up.
Oh, I write everything down. If it needs to be remembered, it has to be written down. We have notes. We have notes. I have to take medication in the middle of the night. It's Synthroid for my thyroid. And it says, I had to put a note in front of the toilet on the wall that says, take medicine to remember.
Yeah.
So I take that in the middle of the night. I have notes on the bathroom mirror, on the kitchen, on the microwave. I've put them on the car steering wheel before. I put them everywhere that I can remember. So, and then at night, Greg looks at I make a list for the next day, and he looks at my list. And if I'm going anywhere, he asks me about it, and he asks me if I know where I'm going, because to this day, I can get lost a mile from home and I will panic. I don't know where I am, where I'm going, or why I'm going there. So now we put on the telephone, how you have the MapQuest or the, I forgot what it's called. I forget a lot of words. I do a lot of describing in my life because I can't remember what things are. So as I'm describing, there's something on the telephone that you press and you put in your information, and that's what I go by.
Okay.
So I know where I'm at.
Yeah. It's like a GPS. Is that what you're saying?
I'm sorry?
Is it like putting your information into the GPS?
Yes, that's what it is. It's a GPS.
Okay. Oh, we're a team. We work together. I just want to say a couple things that you talked about with Greg getting upset with your having to repeat. I get that. I understand. And I know what because it happens. And as a person without the brain injury, it's difficult. And you have to really make yourself realize that the person is not doing this on purpose. The person is doing it because they are unable to not do it. But it's hard. And I think that communication between the survivor and the caregiver is key in that, to talk about what the problems are when something is bothering you, because I find that that works with David and me. We do a lot of communicating between us when something is not going quite right, because I don't always know. As the caregiver, I don't always know what he needs, and I think I do. And so I'm going to give a little example here because I think this is kind of important. I'm always on David's beck and call, basically, because I'm able, and he's not able to do a lot of things. And I don't want him to struggle, and I don't want to make his life harder. So I will often anticipate things that I think he'll need. Well, that sounds lovely, and it sounds great, and it sounds I don't know what the word I want here is, but it sounds like, oh, wow, isn't she a wonderful person? You know, she takes really good care and she wants, but David would get angry with me occasionally. He would like, I can do it. I can do this myself. And I would say, but I'm just trying to help you, you know, and so when he would do that, it would hurt my feelings. Basically, that's what it was. It would hurt my feelings, and I would like, well, then why should I help you? You know, not out loud, of course.
Oh,
why should I help you if you don't want my help, you know? But when we started to talk about it, I understood why he says, I can do it myself. And it's because he needs his independence. So I was being overly protective. I was doing too much for him. And so that was how he was losing self-esteem, because he couldn't open the bottle and I could. And so
right.
he would want to try. He'd want to do it himself. Well, now I understand. And so I backed off totally on so many things, and it's worked out a whole lot better. So I'm not, you know, and here I'm doing this, and not necessarily because I just, like, really am so excited about going and pouring the cereal. I mean, I had to get up off whatever I was
right.
doing and go pour. And I'm only giving an example. This isn't really true. But I'd have to get up off the computer and go do something and to help him out, pour his cereal. And so it's not like I'm getting great joy out of doing it, but I was doing it because I wanted to help him. So once I realized that he didn't need that help and he preferred not to have the help, then I was able to settle into it, and we both are living happily ever after. So, you know, that I think that's the key. It's the communication. You got to talk. You've got to let your partner know what is working and what isn't working for you. You know, and David will tell me, yeah, I need help. I'll ask you if I need help. You know, and when, you know, and he did. He broke a glass the other day. And I came home from the theater, and it was still on the floor, although he had spent an hour already trying to clean it up. That broke my heart. I said, why did you just leave it? I would have done it for you. But no, he got down on the floor, and he swept it up, and then he actually mopped each tile by hand on the floor to make sure he got all the glass up. And I was like, but I could have done it for you. You didn't have to do that. But he needed to do it. And so when I got home after the hour of him doing it, he was like, okay, yeah, he still continued, but he still allowed me to help him at that point. You know, and that's the kind of thing. You just have to work it out and figure it out together. You know, I think that's what
you do.
Everybody needs to do, not even in just brain injury. I mean, it's just a normal everyday, you know, getting along together with somebody, your partner in life or whatever. So that's one thing. And the other thing I wanted to talk about too here was, when you mentioned that Greg has PTSD because of this, I totally get that. I am not diagnosed with PTSD, but I can tell you that I think I have
He's
PTSD.
He's not either. He will never talk about it. He won't go to a counselor.
Yeah.
I'm actually surprised if he's even listening to this interview, because he will never read my book, and he just can't talk about it. It's all
stuffed
down.
Oh, I think it's healing to do that. I think it's healing to talk about it. And I hope he
will
listen
to it. Well,
it was for
me.
Even if it's not listening now. Yeah, even if he's not listening now, maybe he'll listen after the show. But I think it is healing to discuss it, to talk about it. I mean, my whole life revolves around brain injury now. For 17 years. That's almost the biggest focus in my life is brain injury, with all the things I do with the radio show, the blogs, you know, the books, the articles that I write. It's really important for me to get the word out and to try to help other people. So, but I can understand too, but my PTSD was caused pretty much by insurance companies. Insurance companies, phone calls, when someone calls here, I cannot answer the phone. I mean, I have, when you call, I see your name. So I answer, you know, but if I didn't have your name, and I think the first time I didn't answer because I didn't recognize the name right away, I won't answer because I am petrified of phone calls. Now, the insurance company doesn't call that much anymore. We don't have that much dealing with insurance company. But the first maybe 10, 13 years, I was inundated with insurance company calls, and it caused PTSD. Even going to the mailbox and seeing the insurance company a name on an envelope would send me in a panic, you know? And loud noises will do that to me now, because I'm always fearful of David falling. And so anytime I hear a bang in the house, I you know, are you okay? You know, but my heart starts beating crazily. So if Greg's listening, I totally get it. I totally understand. What you're feeling is real. You know, it is. So anyhow, let me see where I'm at here now. Oh, we're talking about your journal, Dawn. And I'm glad you were talking about that, and I'm glad you started the journal to keep track of details of both your and Veronica's brain injury, because it's a journey that you're not going to remember way down the line if you don't. And I did that too. I didn't call it a journal. I just was writing in a notebook, just taking notes. This doctor said this. This therapist told me to do this. I should call this person. Insurance company needs an answer on this, but I would just write everything down. David coughed today. Yay, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Everything is, even the little teeny tiny things, and I actually did it more to keep me organized and to know what happened for the days and weeks before, and in the hospital
because they run together.
Yes, they do. I came in contact with hundreds of people. You know, the medical professionals, therapists, family, friends, visitors. So I jotted everything down so I could write what I called, and I'll put this in quotes, our updates. And I wrote them almost every night, and they were emails that I sent out each night to family and friends who wanted to know what was happening to David. Because, of course, I was getting tons of emails, and everybody wanted to know what's going on. So if you think about those Christmas letters that you get once a year, the holiday letters, and everybody puts their entire life into a page, well, that's kind of what was going out every single day for David, so that people, I didn't have to write a million emails. I wrote one. It was very comprehensive, though. And so I knew exactly when David got his tracheostomy. I knew exactly when he got his GPEG. I knew the date. I knew the time when the doctor sent him over to get a fluoroscopy, you know, swallow test. So I was able to have all that at my mm-hmm. fingertips, which in the end turned out to be the fodder for my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, which I did not have any intention of writing. I didn't expect to write a book. I had no plans to write a book. I was thinking more like I should write a manual, which you also mentioned in your book, about what to expect when you have a brain injury. You know, what to expect. Expect the Arctic blanket when your temperature gets so high that they have to cool you down. Expect them to want to do a GPEG on you because they have to feed you, and they feed you right into your stomach. Mm-hmm. Expect a tracheotomy or a ventilator. Those are the kinds of things that are scary as all can be, and yet they're happening to all of us, and we all don't know about it.
Right.
So a manual like that would be good, and that's what I thought I'd write. I usually write books for children. You know, that was my forte. That's what I'm trying to get published in and have been in the past. But I'm not a book for adults. So I was wondering, did you use your journal notes as your basis for writing your book, A Miracle a Day, One Day at a Time, Hope After Traumatic Brain Injury?
Actually,
it's a long
when
title.
I started the journal, I wrote in the very inside of the cover of my spiral notebook, the date of our accident, February 2008, and then I wrote, a miracle a day, one day at a time, Veronica will get better. And that's what I used for the title, a miracle a day, one day at a time. And I felt like a miracle was happening every day. Every time Veronica did just one more thing, the little things,
yeah.
They all add up. So I used my journal in my book, and yes, I always knew I would write a book, but I never knew it would be about our journey.
Uh-huh. Yeah. No, well, I never did either. Well, because we never expected to have that journey, number one, you know. And once we did, I mean, even still, I didn't start writing my book for another year. It wasn't until 2006. It was around January 2006, and I was writing that book. And then I think in January 2007, Lee Woodruff came out with her book In an Instant, which is a wonderful book too, if anyone wants to read that. Just briefly, Lee's husband is a journalist, and he was over in Tariq in Afghanistan, I think, and he was riding in a Humvee or something. I might get some of this wrong, but they went over an IED, and part of his head was, you know, he was damaged, very seriously damaged. But he's fine now. He's back at his job. So that's a really good story to listen to for or to read because of it also provides a lot of hope. But I was like oh my God, somebody else can understand me. Somebody can understand what's going on. Because prior to my book, prior to when this happened to David in 2000, whenever it was, five, there was so little information out there. There were very, very few books, and believe me, I read them. I read everything I could get my hands on because I needed to know what was going on in my life. I needed an anchor. I needed something to hang on to. And so I was grasping at anything I could get, and there were very little things. So, when Lee's book came out later, and it took me a longer time to write it, I was still teaching school, and I started in 06, but I didn't publish it, I think. Well, what did I say? 2018. I finished it in 2013, 2014, and then it went into getting published. But anyhow, another thing, you just mentioned that you wanted to acknowledge Veronica's every accomplishment, her every achievement. And I read this quote in your book, Dawn, and it said, "We found strength in every single accomplishment she made, no matter how small. Every achievement seemed huge to us." And that was a quote from Dawn's book. And of course, you know, I totally can relate to that because, of course, you're speaking of Veronica, and I couldn't agree more with your sentiments. When David was in a coma and even afterwards at the rehab hospital, and frankly, even till this day, I celebrate. We both do, but I do probably more than he does. I celebrate each little gain that he makes. I'm his biggest cheerleader, and no gain is too small. I even have a category on my blog on surviving traumatic brain injury. It's called Itty Bitty Giant Steps. Go read those. Those are fun.
Oh,
and
I love it.
To the audience out there. Itty Bitty Giant Steps. Tying a shoe for the first time. I have one girl, and I'm just so, I mean, I tell the story all the time because it's just amazing. She had a brain injury. She couldn't tie her shoes. It was, I mean, David, I can relate to that. David can't do it either. Still can't do it. But, you know, she was so excited one day on Facebook because she tied her shoes. And I said, "Can I post that, you know, on my blog?" And she said, "Yes, absolutely," with her name. And I was just so, I was as excited for her as she was. I was so excited when David bent over one day to pick something up. He has very serious balance issues. A medium-sized breeze can really knock him over. That's how sensitive his balance is. And so we were standing at the laundry machine, and he dropped something, and he just bent down and picked it up. And I was like, "Holy moly! What, you know? Do you realize how much balance that took to do that?" And he just did it without thinking, just, you know, not with planning, just do it. He just did it. And it was like, "Oh, my God, that is so cool." And those are the kinds of things that made me think I really want to celebrate everyone else's itty-bitty giant steps, too, because I think that's when we acknowledge each other, I think it gives us more strength, and we give each other strength to go on like this. So if you want to read a lot of stories from survivors, you can go to my blog and look up Itty Bitty Giant Steps. Remember that right-hand column? It's all right there. Tons of stuff for you. So let's see. There was one more thing you talked about, changing roles. When you said that you needed Greg to take over the prescription filling, and he wasn't able to do that,
and
he continued to do that. We had to change roles completely. David was the person who took care of all the financials. He took care of all of the mail. The only thing I would do is I would collect the mail from the mailbox, take out all the good stuff, you know, that I liked, and left everything else for him. Even all the garbage stuff, you know, the flyers, I'd leave all that for him. But he took all care of all of the mail, paid all the bills. Well, guess what? When he's in a coma, how do you think the bills are going to get paid? When I don't know how to do it. And I'm talking, I was much older at this time. And I didn't know how to get money from an ATM. Now, I'm really dating myself because I don't know if anyone even uses ATMs now. but I couldn't even get into an ATM. And that's not David's fault. It's mine. Because he took me to the ATM, I cannot tell you how many times, showed me how to do it, and I refused to do it. Mm-hmm. I refused to learn.
But you don't pay attention.
Because I didn't need to. I had my jobs. I did my things in the family. But that wasn't one of them that I did, and I didn't want it. So I just didn't pay attention. You're right. But when it came to now, I've run out of money, because I used to be able to say, just put my hand out, and he'd put a 20 in, you know, or a 10 or whatever I needed.
Yes.
And so he was
my
husband
human is now.
You know, I don't need that.
For me.
He's my human ATM. So, but when he's in a coma and I don't know the code, because I didn't bother to write it down, even though he told me a million times, I am in trouble, because I don't have any money now. Fortunately, I had some good friends that loaned me money, and when I was finally able, after 3 months, to get to the bank and figure all this stuff out, I was able to return their gracious loan. But you know, so the moral of telling people the story is you need to know your partner's roles, especially those big ones that have to get done, like the prescriptions.
Yes.
You know, they have to get filled. And you have, and if things are different, it's not just taking a prescription anymore to the pharmacy. It is all this calling it all in and all that kind of stuff. And there's then the mail order prescriptions and things like that. So there is a trick to it. Yeah. So,
and then
I'm glad you're still with a able brain to do it.
With a brain injury, sometimes, like as far as the medicine, we can't do the kind that comes to your house, because with Veronica, her moods are so labile that she's very unstable, and she has been for the last couple years. She was on a medicine that worked really well for 8 years, but it made her numb, and it was exaggerated her brain injury symptoms. She even had a worse memory on the medicine, and so now we're trying all these different medicines and nothing's working. So she'll have good days when she starts the medicine, and then we know it's not enough because she'll start having the same symptoms and back and forth. And we've been doing this for such a long time now, and she's so miserable. And it's not her fault.
Oh.
It's from her brain injury.
Yeah. That's so sad. And as a mom or a parent, having to watch your child be so miserable because of something is so, it's so sad, you know?
Yes.
It's just it's
and
very
what's
hard
interesting
to
me,
deal with.
I've talked to a lot of people. Like, I'm on support groups on Facebook for brain injuries.
Uh-huh.
And
right.
A lot of people get injured different ways, but the road back is very similar for all of us.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
And I've noticed that. So even if somebody didn't get the brain injury the way your husband did and you wrote your book, or the way my daughter and I did, and I wrote my book, they can still get a lot out of the book.
Absolutely. And one of the big things is to know that you're not alone, you know, that there are. And
yes.
That's what I needed so desperately in 2005 when this happened. I needed to know. I mean, truly, and this sounds ridiculous, but I didn't know anybody that had a brain injury. I'd never really heard about traumatic brain injury. And I thought we were the only ones that ever had it. You know, obviously that's kind of an exaggeration. I didn't have anybody to tap into and say, so how did it work for you? Or what do you think I should be doing?
Right.
I couldn't get any advice anywhere. And you can't just sit with the doctors for hours and discuss it. So, you know,
the doctors
when I
have
finally,
no idea.
Oh, yes, I know what you mean.
The doctors know about it from a logical perspective and the stuff they've been taught in school. They do not know
which
how
is not
it
very
feels.
Much.
They don't have any feelings about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they can't comprehend it. I think that's part of it. You know, okay, and there I'm probably going to deviate too, because he's getting me excited about some other things here. But David taught medical students at Columbia University, and he was telling us that they don't teach the brain. they don't teach the healing of the brain or the all of that stuff. They might now, but not back when he was still involved with the university. And he was, and he wasn't just talking about Columbia. He was talking about universities in general that train medical doctors. They really don't know much about brain injury. And I like to make this correlation between, because I think it helps to be, people to understand. I think it was back in the 50s. I think that's the year, maybe late 50s, when Barbara Bush got cancer. And cancer was the C word. It was, you didn't say cancer because you knew that was horrible. And nobody really talked about it except, you know, you knew that if you got cancer, you're probably going to die, that kind of thing. And Barbara Bush brought it out, put it in front of all of our faces, and let us know what cancer is when she shared her life and her story with us about cancer. And I think it was at that time, and maybe they were doing research before, but I think research really, you know, it's been a lot of years now. We're talking 70 years when I go back. Holy moly, that's a long time. Whatever the years are, that's a long time. But when she, you know, we've had 70 years or 60 or 50 or years of cancer research. Well, I think that's where we are in traumatic brain injury and brain research. I think we're at that level. And I think when we talk 50 years from now, because we'll have this conversation, Dawn, in 50 years, I know, and we'll be able to say something different. We'll say brain injury was in its infancy state at that time, and people didn't know much about it.
Yes.
But they're going to know a lot more about it. Brain injury is going to be more curable. They'll be able to have things that they can do to go in and manipulate. I mean, that's based on the cancer science. I'm going to think that because I think it's kind of an interesting thought. Yeah, so, but all, you know, that kind of thing. So I think that's what's happening with the doctors not realizing. I mean, when I met David's first neurosurgeon, David had 3 brain surgeries in less than 2 weeks. Every time he'd go in for a surgery, they'd come back and tell me he had something else that was wrong and had to go in and repair that because they were ticking time bombs in his head as they were explained to me. But I met his first neurosurgeon as he walked into me. And I always say when people read my book, it will make them laugh, it'll make them cry, it'll make them gasp.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to tell you the gasp, one of the gasps. But and no one's going to remember it, even if you do go out and read the book. You're not going to remember that I told you this. So, but he came in to me and he said, I saw your husband's brain on my computer at home. I got here as soon as I could. I'm relieved, okay? So then he goes and he said, your husband is in really good shape. I'm even more relieved. Then he said, he'll make a good organ donor. And I just stopped. I just crawled into myself when he said those words to me. He was in good health. Yes, he was. All his organs were in good health. And he would make a good organ donor. Not the best thing to tell somebody when you meet them, you know. And my thoughts. I mean, you could go into the book and read what I thought about it. I'm not going to go into that here. But it was like, no, that's not happening to my husband. Nope, nope, nope. But that's just another case of a doctor not realizing that a person can get better. They can heal. David's not back to his normal self. He's never going to be. I don't think anybody in a brain injury ever gets back to their normal self. But you do have the alternative. You have another road to go, another fork in the road, basically. And you can still
doctors
have a happy life.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Doctors always tell you the worst. They told us to find a nursing home for Veronica because she was likely to remain in a vegetative state. They know so little about the human spirit and about the Lord. I'm a really big believer in the Lord. And we watched him perform a miracle on our daughter. She is now 29 and high functioning. She has deficits. They're manageable. They're unfortunate. She lives at home.
Yes.
She can't drive. She can't work. but she's happy. She knows how to find joy in every day. She's loved. She knows how to love. Life is good. We always concentrate on the positive.
Yeah.
Doctors,
and I think
they
that's
just don't know it all.
No, they don't. They don't know it all. And, you know, and you know, frankly, I'm glad they didn't. Because if they did, then
yes.
my husband wouldn't be here with me. And your daughter wouldn't be with
right.
you either. So it's a good thing they don't know it all. So, but they do
yes.
need to learn a little bit more. And like you say, maybe a little more bedside manner might be helpful.
Yes.
You know, yes, my neurosurgeon saved David's life. I am forever grateful to him. But I am not grateful to him for telling me he's going to be an organ donor. And many, many
yes.
other things that happened. And I'm not going to go into those, but you can read about them. That happened because of this physician. He remains nameless in the book. The only thing I do say is that he did save his life, you know, and I'm grateful. I'm very grateful for that. And then we went on to two more surgeries with another surgeon, and fortunately, they did their job well. So, Don, you are coming up on an anniversary. 14 years ago,
yes.
I think it's what it is for you. And for me,
mm-hmm.
it's 17 years. And many folks celebrate their brain injury event that they unwittingly survived. David recently acknowledged his anniversary on January 13th. I said that was 3 days ago. And we actually call this day his rebirth because he came back a different person. He's not the same
mm-hmm.
man that he was before. He kind of thinks he is, but I tell him often that he's not. I'm sorry, David. But anyhow, he's different in many ways. And I always say, if the old David came back, which I miss desperately, I miss him a lot. If the old David came back, I would be really happy. But I would not want to give up this new David. So does that mean
mm-hmm.
I would be in a relationship of bigamy? Because I love both of them. You know, so it's really
mm-hmm.
really weird. But so anyway, and like I said before, he had three brain surgeries, and the doctors were wrong. And I'm grateful for all the extra years that we've had together. And this year we celebrated with French style cheesecake, and it was so yummy. We finished
oh,
it last
nice.
Night. It takes us 4 days to get through it. But I also got David some chocolate frosted cookies from the bakery, and we enjoyed a leisurely lunch poolside at a local restaurant yesterday. And we usually drag out the celebration for at least a week while we relive and rehash the days and weeks after his brain injury. Actually, it's probably more like I relive and rehash with him because he was in
yeah.
a coma and he didn't know anything. So, but we do talk about it. And so I was just wondering, Dawn, with your anniversary, do you acknowledge it with anything special?
We do acknowledge it. And for the first, oh, gosh, probably 10 years, we would, when the kids were in school, they would take school off. Greg would stay home from work. We would all spend the day together. We would play games. We would stay in. Part of it was from
uh-huh.
here. We were afraid that something else was going to happen.
Oh,
so we stayed
uh-huh.
in. But now Veronica and I will go out to lunch. We'll go to the movies. Everybody doesn't stay home anymore, and we're not afraid anymore because we believe that when something's going to happen, it's going to happen. And we believed that
uh-huh.
before, but there was so much fear, so much fear.
Yeah.
But now we're not afraid anymore.
Well, that's good.
So,
and I think, you know, then you can celebrate the joy of being together, of having the life that you almost didn't have, you know?
You
and
know what?
So
I don't look back at how Veronica used to be. I can't imagine our life any other way. I can't imagine
uh-huh.
me any other way. I can't imagine her any other way. We have completely accepted it. That doesn't mean we like everything.
Yeah.
But we have accepted it.
Yeah. And I can say probably the same thing with me, too. if we could go back and not have it, would I do that? Probably, yeah. Because our life has changed so drastically, and so many limitations have been put on our life. We all know that can't happen. So why be miserable about it? You know, you can't.
But Veronica,
you just have to deal.
Veronica believes she's the better person. Veronica believes she's a better person
many,
now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've had
so
many
to go
people
back,
tell me
I don't
that.
Know if she would want to.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've had many people tell me that. And in my interviews, I'm not sure if you did on yours. I don't remember. But a lot of people, and the first time I ever heard it was I was at my writing group, and David was there too for some reason. And there was a woman who had MS, and she was in a wheelchair, and very, very limited that way because she could barely walk at all. But she could maneuver somehow through her house using her wheelchair mm-hmm. and getting herself from making the transfers. And so she and David were having this conversation, and he, I guess, asked her, what did she feel? He said, you know, something like, would you go back to your normal, your old life if you could? And she said, no. And I sat up straighter, like, what? Are you kidding me? And she said, no, I'm a better person now. I like myself better. So, and this is a woman who was about mm-hmm. 60 at the time. So, but it's not an unusual statement to hear. I was shocked in the beginning. I'm not so shocked now. I know a lot of listeners might be shocked to hear that because it's not at all what you expect. But it is interesting. Like I said, I probably would go back to our other life only because it would take a lot of the pressure off of me. David would be driving.
Mm-hmm.
We would be traveling. He would be the one behind the wheel. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have to do all of that. He would be the one packing the car, things like that when we go where. So I would, you know, he would be the one doing the bills, you know, and taking out the garbage. So, yeah, those role changes things.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind going back and getting rid of some of those. But you know what? It's not going to happen, as I said. It's not going to happen, and I'm not going to worry about it. It is what it is, and I'm so grateful to even just have him here. And we have wonderful conversations because his cognitive brain wasn't damaged one bit. His emotional and his personality, nothing like that really was damaged. It's all physical for him. So being a professor at Columbia, we are grateful for that it wasn't his cognitive brain that was impacted. So
we were
very
impacted. And I went to a counselor for 12 years. I thought I was stupid because of my deficits. And I went to the most wonderful counselor. And she said something that changed my life, like two sentences. Your deficits have nothing to do with your intelligence. You are injured.
Yes.
And those two sentences have changed my entire life. I accept myself as is now. And I thought I did before, but every day I told myself I was stupid. And what a horrible thing to do every day for 12 years.
Yes.
But not anymore.
Yes.
Not anymore. Yeah. So I've grown from it.
Uh-huh. And so that just tells people, too, that if you go to a therapist and you listen, you can get the help you need. You know, if you talk what you need to talk and listen to what they have to say, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. I want to try to get. We have like about 7:33. I have a few more minutes we can go. We have to close down by 45 because a new host will be coming in. So I do want to make sure we're out and not get cut off by them. So, I wanted to say this too, Dawn. I liked this in your story too. And it reminded me of when your doctor dismissed Veronica's hand squeeze as simply a reflex. Now, I'm not a doctor. I've said that before. But I completely disagree. And we had a similar incident. And that's why I was like, oh, my God, yes, I get this. As soon as David was in the recovery room after his first surgery, I tried to get a response for him. I needed to know he was still in there. I mean, he had survived the thing that the doctor didn't think he would, but he did. So in our family, we have a silent signal of three squeezes. That means I love you. I started it when my daughter was about one or two or something like that. And I would just squeeze her hand, and she squeezed three back at me. It meant I love you. And it continued on when my son came and my husband and everything like that. So we always do that. So I did that over and over until I finally got my three squeezes from David, which was my verification that he understood, that he was there, that he had, you know, cognitive, even though he was unconscious in a coma, he still got that. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a reflex. So we also played an awareness game. And I'm telling people this because it's something you can do, and I think it's important to do. But we played an awareness game with David. My son and daughter were on the opposite sides of David's bed. And though David was in a deep coma, we told him the rules to the game. So my son and daughter would ask a simple question requiring a yes or no answer. And if the answer was yes, David would squeeze my daughter's hand. If the answer was no, he'd squeeze my son's hand. So she'd say, "Dad, do I have two sons?" And he would squeeze my son's hand. "No, you don't have two sons." And then she'd say, "Dad, do I have two daughters?" And he squeezed her hand, the correct answer. So we played the game for some time, and it was obvious by David's correct answers that he was aware, somewhat aware, even though he was deep down inside his, you know, psyche somewhere. So I wanted to know, Dawn, what signs did you have that Veronica was trying to communicate to you?
Well, when she was in a minimally conscious state, she would turn her head and try and do – her thing is three kisses, not three hand squeezes.
Oh.
And to this day, I get three kisses, always. And she would turn her head and she would try and do the kisses. And I knew.
Oh. Yeah.
And then I always –
Go ahead. I'm out. It's okay.
Oh,
there's a lag.
There's two things that I prayed to God about. If Veronica was to stay with us, let her know love and happiness. And one of the first things she did, actually the day of the accident, the I love you sign, that the like sign language I love you sign.
Yeah.
She had done that to her dad when he was driving past us, and he did it back to her. Well, when she could barely do anything, she could do the I love you sign. And she started doing it.
So there, it just tells you it's good to have signals beyond speaking with your family and friends so that you can communicate even though you may not be able to speak. Yeah. That brought me to one other thing here that you said in your book, and I wanted to come in on it too. You pleaded that Veronica come back to you, no matter her condition. And I also begged each of David's surgeons, neurosurgeons, to give him back to me. I didn't care how he came back, just that he did. And David came back cognitively intact, but he does have a lot of outward physical disabilities. Still, I just can't tell you that we are just so grateful. And we'll live with those. We'll deal with those. We'll do whatever we can with those. So, and I was going to ask you about your thoughts on Veronica's disabilities, but I think I pretty much get that and understand what you're saying now with that. So that's really terrific that you were, you know, be able
her
to
disabilities
to do
are different than
that.
Your husband's, though. Her, she has really, she's very impulsive, and she has poor decision-making skills. And so she needs to be kind of watched over a little bit. Like, she can't manage money at all. And, it's funny. She thinks more quickly than I do. My comprehension is kind of slow, and I have to have people repeat things sometimes because I don't get it. But she doesn't have that. And here, her injury was more severe than mine, but she's better off in those ways. It's interesting.
Yeah. Interesting, though, that you say that, because is she better off? You have to wonder that, too, because in the what she has, now I've seen pictures of both you and Veronica, and you both look what we call, quote, normal in the brain injury community. You don't look
me
like
nothing.
You had I know, you look normal, and so you must be normal, right? Because isn't that what
people
all your friends and family think?
Veronica could barely do anything, And someone would come in and say, well, you look great. You must be okay.
Yeah, exactly.
No.
And that's my point. It's not okay. And that's what people don't understand. Now, David presents with brain injury symptoms. You can see it. People, so he gets the, he gets the empathy maybe is what I'm trying to say. Now, if you were standing there or Veronica was standing next to David and you were complaining about some things that were going on, your memory or your, or Veronica's non-filters and things like that, people wouldn't think there was any problem that you don't have a brain injury. You're okay. What's the matter with you? You know? And I think that
when somebody goes into a room with a bunch of people and lifts their shirt, there's something going on.
Yes, yes. But see, that's what people, well, I mean, they would get it then. I think they would get it. That's pretty obvious, pretty blatant. But, you know, just to have them standing next to each other, people don't understand the invisible brain injury. And that's one of the things that I talk about on my show almost every week because I think it's so important for people to hear it. To hear, you know, if I'm, you know, if I reach one or two people every week, that means one or two people more will understand what brain injury is, not only the visible brain injury, but also the invisible brain injury. Because I think there are so many people that have the invisible, and it makes their life very, very difficult because people don't get it. They think they're okay, and why are you being so lazy? Why are you not doing this? Why aren't you going out with me? I know I'm getting the triggers there. But, Dawn, it's 7:41, and we have only 4 minutes, so I have to close down. So let me just do my ending show, and we'll say good night. But I just want to thank Dawn Wasserman-Corbelli, the author of, and I have to pull this up because it's such a long title, A Miracle a Day. One Day at a Time, Hope After Traumatic Brain Injury. It's a good title. But, you know, so if you put in a miracle day, a day in Corbelli, you'll find it, I'm sure. Okay, Corbelli. Dawn Corbelli is the author of that book. And so you can always find out more about Dawn on my blog at survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. Again, Corbelli. Just put it in the search box and it'll come up. And she'll have her interview up is already posted. It's already published. And this radio show link will be there probably by tomorrow or Tuesday. So you can go back. Even if you've heard it already and you want to hear it again, go back and listen again. It's easy. So you can read interviews of other TBI survivors and caregivers on my blog. Again, I'll give it to you, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. You can learn more about me at DonnaFigurski.com. There's a category for brain injury resources, and I'm back on survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. So there's a category for resources, brain injury resources, the itty bitty giant steps. People can write blogs. So Dawn, if you're interested in writing a blog post, just contact me and we can. There's if you have an accomplishment like the itty bitty giant steps, you can also send that to me at DonnaO'Donnell@gmail.com. And let's see, don't forget you can read my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale. You can find it at all your local book haunts and in your libraries. If it's not there, ask them to get it for you. They can. It's easily accessible. And it comes in print, it comes in ebook, and it comes in audiobook for those of you who may be challenged to read. Because a lot, I know David's challenge, he loves the audiobooks. So, so as I always say, if you liked my show, tell 10 of your friends. If you hated it, tell 10 of your enemies. That works for me. So, as the clock is ticking up to 7:45, I'm going to say thank you to Dawn Wasserman-Corbelli. For sharing so much of your life with us today. I really, really appreciate that and offering all of the good information that you have. And
thank you.
Don't forget to tune in to the next show. Come up at 7:45. So we're going to get off and say goodbye, everybody. Thank you for listening. Remember to tune in 3 weeks. That will be February. Come on, calendar fast. Oh, man. And you want it to go and you just want February 6th. I'll be back to talk about resolutions and see how we're doing with those for this year. So, Dawn, thank you so much for joining me. I really, it was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay. Good night, world.
Good night.